one and all, and welcome to another episode of Hey, Look, Listen, not a BDSM podcast. No, this is a show where a bunch of us nerdy-ass podcasters sit around and talk about games. And today we're going outside our usual safe confines of the world of video games, and instead we'll be talking about none other than Dungeons and or Dragons. I am your humble host, Kevin O'Carroll, and I'm joined today by my intrepid co-host, Liam Sheehan. Say hi, intrepid co-host.
Hi.
It was worth a try. Now, as I mentioned, we are talking about D&D today, the game played at tables by nerds with neckbeards. But before that, getting to our usual stuff, Liam, what are you playing?
I haven't been playing much recently, Kev. I actually had been kind of looking for stuff I can play while watching shitty YouTube, you know? Mm-hmm. So of all things, I've been playing Smash Brothers Ultimate.
Oh,
I know. Yeah, I've been like mostly against just computer players, but the online seems to be still rattling around. You know, the kind of not very good online of Smash Bros. Ultimate, and I don't know if it's like residue of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, but I've mainly just been playing as Cloud. Okay. I really just enjoy playing as Cloud, even outside of my fandom. But yeah, Smash Bros. Ultimate. That's
a really, really good, really important game that I had completely forgotten existed.
It was huge. It shone so brightly. I kind of forgot it as well. But I've been having fun. I've been kind of casually playing that. But I have something that's tangentially related to video games to talk about briefly.
Go on.
I watched the Fallout TV show.
The Fallout TV show? I've seen the first two episodes of the Fallout TV show.
There we go. Yeah. I've seen all eight of them.
All right, show off.
I know. I can watch TV. I can get Pringle crumbs all over myself while watching a video game adaptation. No, like the best of them. Don't you worry about that. Unlike you, I think I didn't watch this as a fan of the series. Fallout is a kind of a blind spot that I have. You know, I have no ill will towards it. I remember playing 3 back in the day, and I honestly cannot remember why I gave up on it. But it's just a franchise I missed out on. Like New Vegas is very much one of my top games I want to play, get around to. I like keeping games I want to play. It's nice having something to live for sometimes, something to look forward to. So
too real, buddy.
New Vegas, Castlevania Symphony of the Night, Silent Hill 3, Witcher 3, these are my games. I'm just like, so I'll get around to those someday. So I didn't have to come in going like, how is this, does it add up to the lore? Is it a worthwhile adaptation? From what I'm seeing online, everyone seems really happy about it, and I just really enjoyed it. Ella Purnell, the lead, has kind of sat herself on the throne of like queen of video game adaptations now. She was Jinx in Arcane as well.
Oh, shit, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and she's in a kind of cool show called Yellowjacket, so she's great. You got Kyle MacLachlan, he's always a safe pair of hands.
Yeah,
you got that's fantastic. Walton Goggins stealing the show, basically.
Yeah.
And I just liked it. It's really grimy and gross, really good characters. But like I said, I can't talk about it as a fan. I can just say it's a damn good show, and it's kind of made me want to play a Fallout game more than ever. So kind of, if it was meant as, cross-medium synergy, it's definitely worked.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's like, the numbers kind of bear that out as well. I think all of the Fallout games on Steam have like peaked player counts in the last couple of weeks. Like all of them are getting played. Everyone is just kind of into Fallout at the moment. It's awesome. Like we won't get into the whole Fallout thing too much, because I know Marcy is a big Fallout guy and has, capital O opinions on the franchise as a whole. Mm. So hopefully we'll do an episode with him where we'll dive into things a bit more.
That'd be great.
But my one takeaway from the two episodes of the show that I've seen so far is something that I did by accident, and it's kind of ruined it for me a little bit, is I watched a scene on mute and seeing those Brotherhood of Steel guys walking around in their clearly like really light 3D printed armor without the sound effects to make it sound heavy just looks so fucking goofy.
I appreciate that it's a practical effect though in this day and age, so I like it. I like seeing a big metal suit of armor stomping around.
Yeah, and the sound design is great. Like when you're not watching it on mute like a lunatic, there's a lot of weight and heft to the sound of their steps. It's just that, like, the suit clearly isn't heavy, you know?
There's no pleasing you, Kev. You're a quintessential nerd, aren't you? If that was a big CGI suit, you'd be on this podcast going, oh, I remember when they used to do practical effects. Where's RoboCop, Liam? And I'd be like, Kev, calm down. Put the chair down.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
But yeah, and as a kind of more of a Fallout fan, are you in, is it, because I know it's not, unlike let's say the Last of Us TV show, it's not adapting one game, it's just set somewhere in the timeline, isn't it? So are you liking it as a kind of a new puzzle piece to this lore?
Yeah, I think as an adaptation of the vibe of Fallout, they've nailed it. Like the sort of the tone, the setting, the sort of seriousness and pathos mixed with like goofy cartoonish violence and, you know, that sort of retro futurism of the 50s meets sci-fi meets cowboys and shit. It's all good. It's all good stuff. Like I said, we can dive into it more when we have Morrissey on board, but I like, based on first impressions, I think I like it more than most Fallout games. So.
Right. There we go.
Anyway, on to what I'm playing at the moment, which is nothing. So on to the main topic.
No, you're not playing anything?
No, I'm playing Balatro again, and I ranted about that last week, and I'm still working my way through Final Fantasy, and likely will be for months yet to come. With Final Fantasy, I am now at Corel Prison, so under the Gold Saucer. So I'm moving along.
Yep.
It's great. I'm loving it. There's so much to talk about, but we'll get around to it someday. And with Balatro, I mentioned Balatro on this the last time we put an episode out, and a friend of mine sent me a video of a Balatro run where he had basically, like, in Balatro you score points based on your poker hands, and this guy was getting a score that was in, like, exponents, as in, like, 10 to the power of. And I'm sure he'll appreciate the shout-out here, but, like, I watched the video, I spoke to him about it briefly, we stopped messaging, and then I went back and I watched the video again just for the satisfaction of seeing the numbers go up. It's just good shit.
Yeah, I haven't played it, but honestly, when you talked about it in our last episode, I hadn't even heard of it. I was behind it, because it's very much the zeitgeisty indie game at the moment.
For sure.
But I've since watched Marky Brown Game Maker's Toolkit video on it, and I'm very fascinated by it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's really, really good design. But you know what else is a lot of fun and arguably good design? Dungeons and Dragons.
Is that what we're talking about, Kev?
Yeah, we're talking about the 2000 movie Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh yeah, but what's his face? Scar. Jeremy Irons. Summon the dragons. Honestly, that's what he sounds like. Like me riffing. I was like, that was an ace impression.
I think that was a direct quote. Liam, I know you've played D&D because you and I have played D&D together twice, maybe.
Yeah, I can count the amount of times on one hand that I've played it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that you're not a D&D guy.
I wouldn't say that. No.
Yeah. But yeah, so sort of based on your couple of experiences playing it, and I know you're sort of tangentially related to the D&D fandom with a webcomic that you're into in a big way.
Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, it's awesome. But yeah, sort of what's your outsider take on D&D? What's your impression of it? What's your feeling on it?
Just in broad strokes, I'm kind of and always happy that it exists. Always when it was, when I found out it existed when I was young, and it was this kind of niche 70s thing that's gone through the decades. But now it's just so massive. It's probably bigger than it's ever been, and I'm delighted that this is the thing that's kind of rose to like nerdy pantheon heights. You know, I think all the content creators out there who are doing really cool D&D stuff is very nice to see. I think it's very fascinating form of storytelling. I do read a webcomic. It's called Order of the Stick, shout out. That is kind of a comedy fantasy adventure with an ongoing story that's set in a world based around the rules of D&D. And I've been reading it since 2006. It is my longest ongoing narrative commitment I've ever had. When it ends, I will break down in tears. I genuinely love it, and it is genuinely my deepest connection to Dungeons & Dragons. It's so weird that this was such a huge thing, and since I got into it, I've seen other things just, like, rise so much higher than it in terms of, you know, mainstream D&D things, like, you know, all the big YouTube Critical Role, all that. Yeah. Adventure Zone. What's the Dropout one called again, Kev?
Dimension 20.
Dimension 20, exactly.
Yeah, I want to see that live at the weekend, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Very sad. Awesome.
Yeah, it was really good. I won't, like, get into the details on it, because it's, like, it's just watching people play D&D live, but it was fucking great. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Unreal. But, yeah, I'm very much here as a soundboard for you to bounce off of, because I'm not the dynamic here is that you're a big D&D guy and I'm not very much a D&D guy, but I'd like to let it be known here at this early juncture that I have nothing but love and respect for it. Just, you know, I can't be nerdy about all the things, you know. I watch enough of, like, 90s anime, you know. I gotta do that. And like I said, I do read a webcomic about it since 2006, so I have my fingers in a lot of pies. I don't have time.
Okay. Yeah, there's only so many hours in the day to watch documentaries about the making of Babylon 5.
That is something that I watched directly before this recording, and Kevin was making fun about it. That is true, because Babylon 5 is awesome.
Okay.
Whatever. Like, you like Mass Effect, you better thank Babylon 5 for that.
Yeah, Mass Effect's okay, I guess. Yeah, so I thought what we might do today is talk a little bit about D&D in broad strokes. I think the history of D&D is really interesting, and I think it's really relevant this year in particular, because later this year, for the first time in a decade, we're going to see a new edition of D&D. We've had fifth edition since 2014, and later this year they're going to start rolling out an update, a new rule set for the game, which is something that, obviously, it's fifth edition, it's something they've done a couple of times before in the decades that the game has existed. And usually the rollouts are pretty rocky and pretty interesting. So I suppose what I'll do is start by giving you a bit of background on D&D itself. So the history of D&D spans, like I said, a couple of decades, but I suppose it's close to 50 years at this stage. And like the story contains enough corporate backstabbing and skullduggery to fill a social network-esque Oscar bait drama. So I'll aim for sort of a quick run through. So Liam, I'd like you to strap in now and come with me on a journey to the strange and alien world known only as the 1970s.
Kev, you know when I record this podcast, I'm already in my sex harness.
It's true. Yeah, I was going to ask you if you could put like a bit of reverb on that and like put it on post. Now I just want you to cut the whole thing.
Sorry. Stepping over you're very much getting into the vibe and tone of Dungeons & Dragons, the whole energy of it, and I'm stepping all over it. You could have done this as a solo episode, and I feel like you'd be having more fun.
Yeah, I just really enjoy this sort of no-but energy.
Oh, anyway.
Yeah.
Carry on.
So D&D has its roots in the hobby wargaming scene that kind of kicked off in the early 70s in the States. And wargaming is kind of a blanket term for these games. We have these little armies of guys represented by little miniatures, often ones that you assemble and paint yourself. And you have like big old fights against your opponents using big honking handfuls of dice to determine the outcome. It's kind of like Risk, but with like a character creation screen where you design the look of your guys. So this was really popular in the 70s. It's still really popular now. I know like Warhammer is huge and continues to be. I played a little bit in my teens. You were never a Warhammer guy, were you?
No, my brother is.
Oh, really?
At least, well, he's at least into like Warhammer adjacent media, like the games and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The video games, I should say, sorry.
Yeah, there's I haven't played it, so I can't really offer anything beyond this, but there's a sort of retro style boomer shooter that came out recently called Warhammer 40k Bolt Gun, where you play as like a big blue space marine in a Doom clone, and it looks fucking great. But anyway, back to the point. So in those sort of early days of wargaming, there was kind of two things that kind of held true across the board. One was that your each mini kind of represented a unit, not an individual soldier. So each mini would maybe represent like 20 guys. And then the other thing was that they were really concerned with sort of, and I'm throwing big air quotes here, realism. So they try to like recreate the Napoleonic Wars and recreate real world battles and things like that. It was very much not a fantasy gaming thing at that point. It was war reenactments played out with little plastic guys. And then this, the changes from that are kind of what led to the genesis of D&D. There was this guy called Gary Gygax who created a war game called Chainmail. And Chainmail did the sort of the wargaming thing of having rules for units with swords and archers and cavalry and the like. But Gygax was also a massive Tolkien nerd. So he included rules for like orcs and elves and some like magic and spells. And the sort of the magic systems were influenced by Jack Vance's Dying Earth books. And at the same time that Gygax was putting out Chainmail, another game designer, a guy called Dave Aronson, was working on a game and a setting he called Blackmoor. And he devised this system of like character classes and like gaining XP to level up. But he wasn't a combat rules guy. So he just used the combat rules from Chainmail for ease for his system because it wasn't what he was interested in. He was more interested in character building and developing characters over time. One thing he did in Blackmoor, though, is that he did include rules for one-to-one combat. So rather than each mini or each player controlling like a unit, they would control a single character. I think that was kind of a big deal in the progression of from like war game to what would become role-playing games. People went from saying like my squad of archers attack to my archer attacks. And then it's a very short hop from that to giving the archer a name and a backstory and some motivations and maybe speaking in the first person when you describe his actions, saying like, I attack, maybe doing a silly voice or something. And then maybe you're role playing.
you got a stew going.
You got a stew going. So Aronson and Gygax had worked on a project together previously, the name of which eludes me, but they basically decided to combine their ideas to work on something together that they originally called just the fantasy game and later became D&D. So the first iteration of D&D, so I'm now retroactively referred to as original D&D or OD&D, was a bit of a fucking mess. Rules were all over the place. Production quality was basically non-existent. The entire game was designed and published on like a $2,000 budget. Their entire art budget for the first edition was $100. like they didn't have money to spend on it. They just had an idea. They printed the books. They're just like paper printouts folded over and stapled together. But despite all this, it was a hit. They had kind of tapped into something new and weird and fun, and people fucking loved it. They shifted something like 1,000 copies in the first year in 1974. And then the following year, triple that. Everything they printed, they sold. And they continued to grow in the following years after that. But that's kind of where the problem came in. Because Notorious B.I.G. warned us, more money, more problems. there was like an inherent or intrinsic split in the design side of D&D and then within like D&D as a creative entity and D&D as a published good. Gary Gygax saw D&D as first and foremost a game. He's coming from his wargaming background. D&D was different. It was like there was role playing. It was like individual characters, but he still saw it as first and foremost a game. And as a game, it's like it's something like Monopoly or Cluedo or whatever. You can make it into a product and you could market it and you could sell it. Whereas Dave Aronson always saw it as more like a framework for storytelling. Aronson's view of it was more that it was not something that you would compete in. It was something that you would do together to tell a story, whereas Gygax firmly believed that you could win a game of D&D. Like, from his wargaming background, what we would now know as, like, the dungeon master, or the game master, the DM or GM, whatever, Gygax would see that as more just an arbiter, someone who's there to make sure that the rules are enforced and that things are done correctly. He, in the initial release of D&D, that role was referred to as the referee, not the dungeon master, because...
More sport-like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. More sport-like, more competitive. And Gygax firmly believed that if you were smart and you played D&D right, in that there was a right way to play it, that you could win at D&D. And Arneson was like the opposite. He was like, it's something that people do when they sit down together and tell a story, and the rules and the dice and the framework facilitates the storytelling, rather than the storytelling being something that happens when you play the game.
It's interesting, because I always hear that about D&D, and, you know, I always be fascinated by hearing dungeon masters talk about it, how you know, your job is to kind of, you know, create this world but go with the flow of the player, of the players. But during lockdown, I made a couple of games that people could play over Zoom or whatever. I think you played one of them, Kevin, or two, maybe.
I played two of them. Three? Three, two,
yeah. But I will admit, though, my whole thing was, they weren't D&D now, it is comparable, though. But my whole thing was, you're here to solve this game that I played, and I will put any restriction on you from, you know, stepping out of my quote-unquote boundaries, which is probably the polar opposite of what some people want and that kind of thing, but it's exactly what I want. I was like, solve my puzzle that I made, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting, because, like, those games were a lot of fun, Liam, and I really appreciate it, because it was during the lockdowns when things were quite grim, so any kind of socializing was good. Where I got to, like, engage my brain was really appreciated, because I was not doing a lot of that at the time. But it's interesting, because the sort of puzzles and stuff that you had put into that game, which was more like, it was closer to like an escape room than a role-playing game, but it was an escape room without maps or props. So it was kind of role-playing our way around an escape room. It was a lot of fun.
I thought of them as a kind of a LucasArts adventure games that existed in, you know, our shared imagination.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And like, and the puzzles in that worked really well, specifically because of what you said there, where you were able to control the confines of it. Interestingly, like, puzzles in D&D, a lot of the time, kind of suck. It's one thing in D&D that I really, like, don't vibe with that much, because you could be playing as a wizard who has, like, max intelligence. You're, like, the smartest guy in any room, and that's your character. And then the person piloting him is Kevin, the dumb sack of meat who doesn't know. So there's this mismatch in between what you know and what your character knows, or the other way around. If you're playing like a dumb barbarian, and no one else in the party gets the puzzle and you do, and you'd be like, well, it doesn't make sense for my character to have figured this out, but here we are. So the split. There was this ideological split in what D&D was between Gygax and Arneson, and then there was a monetary financial split. Arneson was not a business guy. Gygax was kind of, he was a game designer, but he was also business savvy. So when the time came to put out D&D for the first time in 74, Gygax formed this company called TSR. And Arneson was not involved in the company. Reports vary on it, kind of, that he didn't want to be, or Gygax didn't want him to be. I don't know what the truth of it is. But yeah, Gygax, and he got some friends of his, some money guys in, and they ran TSR. They were like the publishers, and Arneson was, you know, on the creative team, but not involved in the money side of it. And this kind of led to a big divide down the line, where, as I said, Gygax saw it as a game and as a product. And here's the thing with a role-playing game as a product. If me and you, Liam, and like five of our friends decide we want to play D&D this weekend, and none of us have any D&D products or any D&D books, one of us goes out and buys maybe just the Dungeon Master's Guide, one book, and there's probably enough information in that for us to run the game. And if we like it, we can just kind of homebrew and make up the rules and we can keep playing. And all seven of us could play once a week for the next year and play a full campaign and have a lovely old time and still only have bought that one book.
Yeah.
Inherently, it's hard to make money off it.
It makes sense, yeah.
Because, and it's something that we see in video games nowadays, where's the recurring spending? You can't put microtransactions in. More on that later. But so how do you make money off it? Gygax's solution was to release supplements, campaign settings. They'd have booklets that were like a little campaign that you could play through, or booklets that describe a new world or something, and they'd have rules for adventuring in that area. They'd have like random tables you could roll on to roll random encounters that have stat blocks for new monsters and things. And again, those things sold like hotcakes, but again, only one person in each playing group needs to buy it, you know? Usually the DM. So it kind of got to a point where they were realizing the only way to make money off this is to keep selling to the people who are already invested, but the people who are already invested already have the core rulebook that they need to play. So how do you sell more stuff to them? You create a new core rulebook.
A new edition, is it?
Basically, yeah. So the first thing they did was they created a split within OD&D. They had like the basic rules, which was kind of the original setup for it. And then they had the advanced rules, advanced D&D, AD&D. And AD&D was firmly Gygax's baby. Aronson didn't really have anything to do with it. Because, as we said, Gygax was convinced that, you know, D&D was a game for intellectuals and, you know, it had to be harder and tougher to win so that your wins were more meaningful. Gygax, as an aside, kind of a shitty dude.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's
like the king of Dungeons & Dragons, though.
Yeah, kind of. He's the king of Dungeons & Dragons in that he was in control of the money for a long time and got his name on the books and kind of was able to control the narrative. There's a real case we made that Aronson was the more creative force, but Gygax was the more publicly known one. Mm. Had some shitty opinions around women and stuff. Even his own daughters, saying that they were, you know, that women lacked the intellect to play D&D, and used his own daughters as an example. Not great.
So Gygax was a Rick and Morty fan, was he?
If Gygax was alive today, he 100% would be a Rick and Morty fan. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so they did the advanced rules. They had the sort of the advanced and basic split in the hope that by splitting the edition into two that, you know, collectors or people would want to buy both, and you're kind of doubling your revenue stream then. And eventually they did come out with a second edition specifically for AD&D, for advanced D&D. And that's when they hit into a problem that would occur again and again as they progress through this, is the creative side wanted to make new rules and new content, and the business side wanted to make sure that as much of it was backwards compatible with the old stuff as possible, because they didn't want to exclude any of the old fans. So you had this tug of war where they're trying to create new stuff, but make sure it works with all the old stuff. So you end up with something that's kind of neither, something that doesn't push the game forward, but also doesn't really gel with anything that came before it. Mm. I think there's some parallels there with, you know, console generation changes. If you look at the dialogue around the transition from PS4 to PS5, and how there's been some very outspoken, frankly shitty people complaining about a lot of the PlayStation exclusives being cross-gen for the first couple of years of the PS5's existence. Did you see any of that?
Yeah, people wanted the true next-gen experience, but from my point of view, it allowed me to play, you know, the likes of God of War and Elden Ring before I was able to afford a PS5, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it the games still run beautifully on PS5. They just also ran on PS4. I remember when it was announced that God of War Ragnarok was coming to both platforms. Did you see the news story about Alana Pierce getting like sexually motivated death threats as if it was her fault?
Because she's a writer on it.
Because she was a writer on it. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
So,
that adds up.
Yeah. So I don't know if anyone was writing sexually motivated death threats to Gary Gygax around the release of AD&D 2.
Hold on, I'll research it.
How's that for a seamless segue?
It was, like you said, seamless is the word.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a pattern that we'd see repeated moving forward with D&D. So without getting into the nitty and gritty of it, TSR, the company, just basically spent about a decade shitting in their own hands and clapping, just mismanaging money. They cut Dave Aronson out, and he launched like 5 lawsuits against them, and then eventually they had to back down and put his name on everything, even the stuff that he wasn't involved in the making of, and he got like 3% of their revenue in perpetuity. Gygax's friend that he brought in, the money guy, brought in his brother, and then they ended up having like nearly 50% in the company, and they wanted to sell to Gygax, and Gygax got greedy and wanted a better deal, so they sold to someone else who ended up taking over the company and cutting Gygax out. There's this whole Succession-esque corporate backstabbing going on that basically meant that by the time we got to about the year 2000, the company was done. Like, the as a product, it was still popular. People were still playing D&D, but TSR had run itself into the ground, and it got scooped up by a little card company called Wizards of the Coast.
I was wondering, I thought this name would have dropped much earlier. It shows how much I know about the lore.
Yeah, history. I think Wizards took them over in like 99 or so.
Right.
And they started releasing stuff under the name TSR, but eventually dropped that and just took it over whole hog. So basically the Wizards were sort of best known at the time as the team behind Magic the Gathering, or as it's also known, just a fucking license to print money. They had launched Magic in the early 90s, and it was just massively successful. And I mean, continues to be now, but like in the 90s, Magic was basically, they were printing cards and they might as well have just been printing their own money. It was ludicrous how successful it was. So like the team at Wizards at the time were still massive nerds. The business guys hadn't taken over yet. And they basically took over a nearly bankrupt TSR with the intention of saving D&D. They spent a couple of years and a lot of money on it and developed basically a third edition for D&D. They kind of folded the basic and the advanced rules back in together to create like a unified game line. It was the biggest revision of the D&D rule set since its inception in the 70s. A lot of what D&D has done and been since has come from this big third edition revision. It was kind of called the D20 system, is the idea of rolling a D20, adding modifiers to it and comparing it against an armor class or a skill check or whatever.
That's where all that came from.
That's kind of where that was sort of codified. And it was
right.
They had created an open gaming license for the D20 system to allow other developers to use it. So there's a lot of sort of independent tabletop RPGs that have existed since then or have sprung up since then that are using modified versions of that D20 system. And it all harks back to this big sea change in D&D at that time. Problem was, kind of sucked. Third edition, people didn't really like it. So I think they spent like 3 years making third edition, and within 3 years had to release a revision. So that's where we have like, you might have heard of 3.5. It wasn't a full new edition, but they kind of did a sort of a reset. And 3.5 was a lot more popular. And a lot of games would be inspired by in time to come. I know, have you heard of a game called Pathfinder? There's a couple of video games.
Yeah. And the very first page of that webcomic I was talking about, Order of the Stick, which although it eventually kind of coalesced into an ongoing epic narrative, which it began as just D&D jokes, and the very first page is the characters fighting a bunch of goblins, and mid-battle they're upgraded to 3.5 edition.
Oh, cool.
So that's, I have the weirdest avenue into the stuff you're talking about, you know?
Cool. So 3.5 was more successful than the first attempt with third edition.
Good.
But it was making money, but Wizards were still using a lot of their Magic the Gathering money to keep D&D afloat. It was very, very much the case that like Magic was the big money maker, and D&D was almost like the vanity project that they were keeping it going as a labor of love, you know? And that was fine until the money guys showed up.
Okay, that's always the way, isn't it?
And by the money guys, I mean international toy conglomerate Hasbro, who bought Wizards.
Right.
And Hasbro were like, we're not going to spend money on this anymore. Hasbro had this like internal policy where of all the companies that they owned and stuff, the companies would have to come to Hasbro head office and would have to pitch how they're going to be successful. I think they were given like a target of like, how are you going to leverage your product to make $1 million? And if you can't make that case, Hasbro would not allocate funds to you. They wouldn't like sell off the company. They wouldn't close it down. You just wouldn't get money from the central pot if you couldn't prove to them how you're going to make your million. So someone like Magic the Gathering, they just like send one guy into the office, like point at the previous year's finances and get their sign off and they're good to go. D&D, not so much. They had to come up with something. So their big swing in the mid-2000s was particularly off the back of the massive success of Warcraft. They were like, nerds who love fantasy games are playing fantasy games on their computer. If we can integrate the computer into the D&D setup, we'll have a platform that we can sell digital content through, which is a way to make recurring spending. They're essentially talking about a virtual tabletop. So they basically started moving towards fourth edition. Fourth edition, in the games, they sort of, in the game side of things, they streamlined and simplified a lot of stuff. They restructured a lot of stuff into these powers that were almost like abilities on a cooldown from a video game.
Yeah.
And they wanted to push the virtual tabletop. So they wanted to make it a more video gamey to appeal to the Warcraft crowd, basically. And it just didn't work because people said, why on earth would I want to play D&D online or on my computer? I play D&D in person.
Hmm.
Now, I mean, post-pandemic, that seems wild because I think the majority of D&D these days is probably played online. But yeah, at the time, it was like, it was just a non-runner. People just weren't interested in doing it. And then that brings us up to 5th edition, the current edition of the game, which I think really feels like it was a last Hail Mary. It kind of feels like D&D were like, okay, we're going to simplify things even further. We're going to make the most streamlined version of the rules that we've even had, arguably to the detriment of the sort of flavor of the game. We're just going to simplify things. We're going to get it out there and hopefully it takes hold. And
yeah,
oh baby, did it take hold.
This is it. This is the moment, is it?
Basically, yeah. And it's a lot of it is down to, in my view anyway, I think Critical Role had a huge impact on it. That, because Critical Role, those guys were playing a home game anyway, and then they decided to stream it. The home game they were playing, they were using Pathfinder, which is a much more complicated rule set, kind of akin to 3.5. When they wanted to go and start streaming it, they wanted a more streamlined rule set that the audience would be able to understand better. So they made the change over to 5th edition. And that just got it in front of so many people. When they blew up, it just got that new rule set in front of people and got them interested in it. And then, obviously, like, I mean, Stranger Things, I think, was a huge huge win for
D&D. Was it really influential? Like, I know Stranger Things was, like, an institution, but did it really get people playing D&D?
Yeah, for sure. Maybe not so much in our spheres, not so much, like, in Ireland, but I think in the States, it did a lot. What you have to remember in the States as well is that, you heard of the Satanic Panic?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. D&D was scapegoated during the Satanic Panic. There was this idea that D&D was evil. That, like, there's this sort of fundamental Christian position that was and kind of still is prevalent in the States. That, like, talking about or pretending to be or to be around witchcraft and demons and magic, that talking about it is the same as engaging with it, that the idea of it is the thing, and that D&D was inherently evil, you know. And there's a lot of, you know, right-wing Christian fundamentalism in the States still, but, like, particularly in the past, and that was a huge influence. So I think having the cast of Stranger Things playing D&D as a game, I think that probably did sway people and bring people around on it, you know?
I would like to think that people weren't looking, like, I'm probably wrong, I'm probably too optimistic again, that when Stranger Things came out in whatever it was, 2015, that people still weren't looking at D&D that way, you know? I'm sure there was a whole swathe of people who were.
I don't know. I see it online sometimes on, like, the, like, D&D subreddits of people coming on and complaining that their mom found out that they had played D&D and now they're banned from going to their friend's house to save their immortal soul. And, like, some of them probably are just farming for upvotes, like sad pathetic Redditors that they are / we are. But some of it's got to be real, right?
Some types of people will always use pop culture as an excuse for not facing proper institutionalized problems that's happening in society. It all, like, happened with video games in a big way in the 2000s.
Yeah.
Do you remember the lawyer Jack Thompson?
Mm.
He was an American lawyer who basically had a whole agenda against video games. We could do an episode on that sometimes, Kev. That was a huge thing, you know. You go back before D&D and there was people calling Penny Dreadful satanic, you know?
Yeah.
It always happens. D&D was just another version of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And you're right. Like, it's scapegoating. It's rather than facing the institutional issues that are around us everywhere, they kind of go, well, it's not society that's wrong. It's not us that's wrong. It's
my daughter read Harry Potter.
Yeah, and that's what made her a lesbian. Yeah, so that brings us up to the present day, basically. D&D is massive. D&D is a hit. Loads of people are buying D&D. And 5th edition has been running for a decade now. And the Hasbro money guys, what do they want? More money. And how do they want it? As easily as possible.
Okay.
So what they are launching this year is, I mean, they refer to it as a backwards compatible evolution of 5th edition, which, I mean, sounds a lot like what they did back in AD&D 2nd edition, where they're trying to create something that's new enough that they can sell it to the same people over again, but that is similar enough to the old stuff that it'll work with the old books. So the people who are already bought in to 5th edition will be able to buy this because it will be compatible with their old stuff. I mean, they've released a lot of playtest material for it over the last year, 18 months or so. And like some of it looks cool. They're tweaking some rules and stuff that have been a bit clunky and a bit just unfun. They're redesigning some of the classes that have been a bit kind of underpowered and like less fun to play. That's all really positive stuff, but it like a couple of class tweaks do not a new edition make. One big thing that they're doing, and this may sound familiar, is investing in heavily in the digital tool set. The same thing that they tried to do with fourth edition, they're trying again now, and they're probably going to see much better success with, where they want to create a digital infrastructure for playing D&D. They want you to play D&D on their virtual tabletop. You'll probably have to pay a monthly subscription to the virtual tabletop. You'll pay a monthly subscription to D&D Beyond, where you have your digital character sheets. You'll buy your books digitally, so you won't ever own them. You'll just have a license and you'll have the access to them through the tabletop. And they, right. they can sell you microtransactions. You can have a little digital miniature of your character, and if you want to upgrade to chainmail from your fucking plate mail or whatever the fuck, you can do that for $2 a pop, you know?
Kevin, this sounds awful like a video game to me.
It really does, doesn't it? Because that's what they've done. They've looked at video games. I think the phrase that the Hasbro CEO used that kind of got out, I was on like an earnings call or something, or a Hasbro web seminar, and it kind of got into the media and got a lot of people worried, is that the Dungeons & Dragons brand is under-monetized.
Oh, well, God. Isn't it? It must rake in millions, though.
Yeah, but it's never enough for these people, is it? It's not enough. Like, making money isn't enough. Growth isn't enough. It has to be exponential growth. It has to be infinite growth. There has to be more. They're making the point that, like, the brand of D&D has never been healthier. That, like, more people than ever are engaging with the brand. There's so much positive sentiment towards the brand. But still, the majority of the spending is the Dungeon Masters, the DMs who buy the books, and they only make up, you know, maybe 20% of the player base. If you have, like, 3 to 5 players at the table and one DM, and only one person out of that 6 or 7 are still spending money, that's the problem that they want to solve. They're not solving gameplay issues with this new edition. They're not trying to push the experience forward for people. They're trying to, and this is a quote, unlock the type of recurrent spending you see in digital games.
There we go.
Yeah. They said the quiet part out loud, and they don't know that it's supposed to be the quiet part, and that's even more annoying.
And you've, in one fell swift, justified doing D&D on our video game podcast.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Oh, you didn't know you had to justify it?
No.
I was waiting the whole time. I wasn't going to release this episode if I wasn't happy. No,
yeah. So that is my not so short and very unresearched synopsis of the entire history of D&D that I didn't realize I was going to rant on about for quite so long.
I learned things.
Yeah.
I didn't wake up today wanting to learn anything. I'm kind of at, you know, I'm at that age now where I think I've learned enough. I just want to coast for the rest of my life.
Oh, buddy, that's so relatable.
So that was interesting, Kev.
Yeah.
But I thought before we started it was going to be you telling me about your D&D games. Because here's as a bookend, Liam gets sassy about something that he doesn't play. Like I said, I love Dungeons & Dragons. I love its success. Even though the business side of it, you know, has me a little bit, you know, my brow furrowed after you telling me about it now. Yeah. Let's just say culturally, I love it. I don't know. Hearing someone talk about their D&D campaign is about as interesting as someone telling you about a dream they had the night before.
Oh,
100%. If I wasn't sitting around that table, I do not give a shit about the very funny thing that happened in your D&D game. That's it. Positive vibes. That's all I got.
No, buddy, I 100% agree with you. I will actively go to great lengths to not discuss my D&D campaign with people outside of the campaign. Because, and you've hit the nail on the head, it doesn't mean anything to anyone who wasn't there. It's
I will admit sometimes like I like kind of, you know, because I have met people who run their own games. And I do like kind of going, you know, what did you make your world around? What was the inspiration? What's the kind of quest that there? I do like kind of hearing where kind of what kind of people have cobbled together, you know, especially yeah. people who might have come up with something really original. But I don't really like the whole kind of, right? And then we were in a chamber with an owlbear and Danny rolled a 5. I'm like, oh God, kill me.
A 5.
And then you always have the person, who is just like, and the D&D wants us to go into this tavern. So I said, I want to have sex with the mug. And I was like, and he was like, no, you can't do that. Oh, I'm being way sassier than I expected to be. Anyway.
No, but for what it's worth, you are 100% correct. Yeah, the two things that I dislike about the state of D&D at the moment are the corporate greed and monetization from Hasbro and talking to people who play D&D.
No, I think as far as hobbies go, I think it's a wonderful thing. Like just boiling it down to people nerding out and kind of residing in their imagination, you know, as someone who kind of grew up on the fringe of just before kind of nerdy things became properly mainstream, and kind of we do have memories of kind of, not like we weren't playing D&D when we were in school, and there's kids all around the world who are playing it now. I think it's a wonderful thing, absolutely wonderful thing that it's become so popular, you know. Yeah, and I think it's like I said earlier, I think it's beautiful that it's been utilized, you know, for storytelling. So you have a lot of people who, to relax after a day of work, will watch, you know, their favorite D&D show, and you know, you're basically following a story in what I think is like a really interesting kind of way to kind of digest a narrative, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's kind of the one thing I'd love people to take away from this is not the corporate skullduggery or the greed or the 5 decades of rules updates that I've bored them with. It's that like Gary Gygax was wrong, Dave Arneson was right. D&D is is a way to tell stories with your friends, to make shit up, to yes and, and then you have the added chaos of the dice deciding whether that silly thing you said you want to do actually happens or not. And it's just fun. It's just a good time. If anyone out there has not played D&D or a tabletop role-playing game and thinks they might be interested in it, like, look into it. Look on meetup.com, try in your local gaming store or something. There's going to be a game on somewhere. They will welcome you. They probably won't be total fucking weirdos, but I can't guarantee that. Your safety is not guaranteed. It's up to you. But just give it a go. Just that's all I'm saying. Just give it a go.
Are you talking to me or the audience?
Well, I mean you too, but you've tried it before at least.
I have, yeah. And it's almost like if you're kind of anyway nerdy, it's impossible to avoid it in your algorithm these days. So I have kind of caught myself listening to the likes of Matt Mercer or Brennan Lee Mulligan kind of wax lyrical about their method of DMing. And I do find it interesting, you know, kind of the way to do it, you know. And it kind of, like I said, I've never ran a D&D game, but I did have you play those games over
also,
the lockdown. And
also, that's not true.
My philosophy is the opposite.
That's not true. You did run a D&D game for us once.
I did, yeah. You were fighting goblins, weren't you?
Yeah. There was like 8 of us and we were absolutely shit-faced and somehow you managed to hold it together. And we played what was supposed to be like a 2-hour adventure, and it took us about 4.5 hours to get halfway through it before we all gave up.
Yeah, I don't think any of us had played D&D that. So I think that might be the last time I actually ever played D&D, Kevin. That was before lockdown, wasn't it? Before the pandemic.
That was pre-pandy, yeah.
Pre-pandy.
All right, I think I've spent long enough up on my D&D branded soapbox, so I think we can wrap it up and leave it there.
Are we getting some kind of license for this? Are we sponsored by D&D?
I think Hasbro are pretty chill about just handing out money, so I'm sure that check is coming any day now.
Are we waiting for the check?
No, I'm for some reason I thought you were going to do the outro, even though.
No, you do the outro.
I know. I get that on an intellectual level. It's just my laziness kicking in. I was like, Liam can wrap it up from here. I'm just going to say bye. So I think that's about all we have time for today. Really appreciate you guys for sticking with us. Hopefully you found this a bit interesting, something a little bit different. If there are any other like tabletop RPGs or board games or things outside the video game sphere that you think would be interesting for us to have a chat about, maybe let us know. You can find us on social media. We are on Instagram at HLLpod. We're also probably still on Twitter, but I don't check it, so I don't know. Shoot us an email if you can figure out the email address. I don't know it, but it probably exists.
And I do apologize that our release schedule has been a little bit wonky, but just let you know, we very much plan on releasing episodes as often as we can, and we are very thankful to everyone who listens.
Yeah, absolutely. We really appreciate it, guys. And if you could spread the good word, maybe share the podcast with members of your D&D group. Who knows? Maybe they haven't heard.
I like that. Yeah. I like that little spin, Nick. That's nice. Yeah.
So that's about it from me. I just want to thank you all again for sticking with us. And until next time, bye.
Bye, guys.